Good evening, and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Our guest this evening is Brian Alfred, innovative contemporary artist, professor, author, and podcast producer. Brian has a BFA from Penn State University, studied at the Skowhegan School of Painting and Sculpture in Skowhegan, Maine, and has a Master's of Fine Arts from Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. He's a professor of art at Penn State University and has a studio in New York. He's exhibited his work in many solo and group exhibitions nationally and internationally, including such galleries as Haunch of Venison in New York, London, and Berlin, museums such as the Salmonar Guggenheim in New York, and Art Basel Fair in Switzerland. Brian is represented by Miles McHenry Gallery, New York, Kubota Gallery in Tokyo, Japan, Hezi Cohn Gallery in Tel Aviv, Israel, and Studio La Cita in Verona, Italy. His work has been recognized with numerous grants, residencies, and awards, and may be found in many permanent collections, corporate and private collections, including the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York, Museum of Fine Arts in Houston, Texas, the National Gallery of Victoria in Melbourne, Australia, and more. His Sound and Vision podcast interviews highlighting renowned contemporary artists are featured on iTunes with a wide subscription base. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Your innovative works have a vibrant style with intriguing techniques you explore to create your paintings, collages, and animations, and some of your series have been described as a montage of painterly vignettes relating the passage of time. What inspires your creative process as your ideas unfold in your works?
It's really just, for me, it's about life and my experiences, what I'm doing and where I travel, the things that interest me at any given time. I'd like to think that in my work, it can be anything that I see or experience or I'm thinking about, and it's really informed by what I'm interested in life at that moment.
And can you describe one of your series or works and how they reflect some of these experiences and what you've discovered?
My most recent show in New York City at Miles McHenry Gallery was called High Rises and Double Vision, Images in New York, and it was basically animation and paintings based on years and years of living in New York and just compiling photographs. I have a 12-year-old son, and I've seen so much more of the city in my experiences with him playing soccer or traveling around or doing whatever, and I think that broadened my understanding of the city. And after years and years of collecting these photographs and being inspired, I just started to work on a series of paintings. And that's specific to New York. There's other ones that are specific to maybe an idea. Like, I've done a show based on surveillance imagery. I've done a show based on like conspiracy theories or portraits just about people who've influenced me. So it's pretty diverse and it's the conceptual drive for each show. But usually there's an overarching theme to the shows that I do. No matter how much I try to do a show where there's not a theme or it's just images that are unrelated necessarily, but it always ends up gelling into something.
Can you take us through the process when you begin with your drawings and go to the paintings, and perhaps one that you've animated, say, Under Thunder and Fluorescent Lights?
Under Thunder was an animation that started actually as an animation that was driven by a lot of imagery related to racetracks and automobile racing. And that stemmed from getting into Formula One racing because my son was watching a lot of it on TV, and we were just getting into that sport, and the aesthetic of it was really intriguing to me, this really stylized, sleek aesthetic, the danger and the speed and the chaos of the sport. It was beauty and danger combined that really visually it attracted me. So I started taking photos of racetracks and trying to see races when I can, and also just sourcing images off the internet. I was also really interested about the way that some of those tracks and some of the graphics in race car driving was really compelling in relation to thinking about abstraction. And a lot of the imagery in that work was born out of that experience. As far as making the work, I think the natural idea is that you start with drawing and then maybe you make some collages and then you make a painting and then you make an animation. But for me, it's more cyclical. It's never quite so linear. Sometimes I'll do an animation first. Sometimes I'll just draw things directly on a painting. Sometimes I'll sketch things out in Illustrator and then project that frame image onto the canvas and then tweak things while I'm painting. And each way that I work, whether it's painting, collage, or animation, they all inform each other. So if I do an animation first, there'll be ideas I get through the effects that I'm doing in the animation that will usually inform what I'm doing in the painting, and vice versa.
Were there some early artists you investigated while working on this group of paintings, or some of your others that are really influential?
Influence is a tricky thing because I think when people see my work, especially early on in my career, people would say, like, oh, you must like Charles Sheeler or Ed Ruscha or Alex Katz. It was like a handful of artists that they felt like my work was in dialogue with. But influence in my work is so vast. It comes from like everything from like growing up watching Bugs Bunny cartoons to Frank Stella to being in Japan and staying at a Japanese hot spring and the lines and the aesthetics, Japanese prints. There's so many influences in my work and on me, and I really take everything in. So it's hard to explicitly say, like, these artists specifically have influenced the way that I make images. I think there's just so many influences that hopefully it unconsciously just washes over me and reflects in some of the work, but it's not one-to-one thing.
Can you discuss perhaps some of your residency experience and how something like that enriches your practice?
I haven't done too many residencies. Skowhegan was right out of graduate school, and it was amazing, and it totally changed my life. But in a way, I think of Skowhegan as almost being like school, because it was right after. I went directly from undergraduate to graduate, and then I went to Skowhegan right after that. They were all very different, but it was a specific time in my life. I did the Islip residency in Long Island, where over a summer I worked in a gigantic studio, and it was really nice. There were a couple other artists there, and I was in dialogue with them, but it was really the getting outside the studio. I think anytime you move spaces, for me personally, it's inspiring. It makes me recalibrate my vision. Maybe more importantly than residencies, the way that my life works now, I teach in Pennsylvania 3 days a week, and I live in New York when I'm not in Pennsylvania, and I'm always moving, and I'm always traveling, and that has a really big effect on my work, what I'm seeing, how I'm experiencing. And I have a studio in Pennsylvania, I have a studio in Brooklyn, and I even make work when I'm traveling on my computer, like I'll do animations or digital drawings on my laptop. So I try to be nomadic in a way. I'd like to think that everywhere I go, my work is different. It's affected by the surroundings that I'm in.
Does your work change depending on where you're exhibiting?
I don't know if the work itself changes as far as subject. Every project is so specific, and I really focus on, like, if I know I have a show coming up in Japan next year, I'm thinking about, okay, the body of work that I'm working on or the ideas that I have, and then I'm starting to shape that. And as I'm working on the work, I am conscious of the space. Let's say there's a gallery that has an immense amount of light in it and a beautiful open space. I'm not going to want to black that out to project an animation. I'll probably show the animation on a monitor, like on a flat screen. And then there's other spaces that are really small, so I'll try to make smaller work. Or if it's Kevin, a huge space, I'll think about maybe breaking out that space or making larger work. And I've done a lot of public stuff too. I really like the challenge and the excitement of the work engaging with the space that it's in. Studio isn't this hermetic box where I just make everything and then I fit it into wherever it's going to go. I am conscious of where things will end up, and I like to consider that dialogue with the space and the place and the viewer that will encounter that work.
Do you envision what the audience might experience, feel, and sense as they view and walk through it?
Totally. Obviously, it makes sense more now than ever, but I feel like such a huge part of making art is communication, and it's talking to people and talking to the viewers, and I don't want it to be a one-way conversation. I'm interested in the interaction with the viewer and that dialogue that the work has with the viewer. I'm not one of those artists who just say, like, I'm just doing my thing, and I put it out there, and if people like it, they do. If not, whatever. I'm really interested in the reaction, and I'm interested in that dialogue.
In going further as far as communicating and discussing art, in April of 2016, you recorded your first podcast, Sound and Vision, and recently produced your 200th episode. How did this insightful and captivating podcast of conversations with contemporary artists and musicians come to be?
Well, it came to be because when I started teaching in Pennsylvania, I drive twice a week, and it's a 4-hour drive to here and back. And I was listening to a lot of podcasts, and I like longer podcasts because it's a long time in the car, and I like to get lost in conversation. So I would listen to a lot of comedians or movie stars or musicians or other people talking about their life, and I found that really engaging. And then I wanted to hear artists, like an artist version of that. And honestly, there weren't really any like that whenever I started mine. So that gave me the impetus to start it. I basically took a year to do research and development and get ready to do it. The great thing about podcasting is really it's complicated in a way, but it's really simple also. It's like two microphones in a room and you're just talking. So it's been wonderful. As far as changing my work, I don't know exactly how it's changed my work. That's kind of like that question when you have kids, how does that change your work? And it changes you and that changes your work. But it's hard to exactly put your finger on how it's done it. I mean, I definitely have a larger community of people that I've met and talked to over the years, and that's been a real gift. And I think it's made me listen, and it's made me consider other people more, and it's taken me outside of myself. And I think that's like another thing that having a child does. It takes you outside of yourself a bit, which I think makes you a little more caring as a human being, less self-centered and all about, because, you know, when you're sitting in a room making art all day and it's you, it can be a little like an infinity loop, but getting outside of that is really important, I think. So I don't know exactly how it's changed the work, but I'm sure it has in a way.
Can you share a few stories or creative processes that you found most intriguing or surprising from some of your podcasts?
I would say that sometimes I'm really shocked at the spaces that people work in, from the big, the small, or, you know what I mean? Like, I've done podcasts in a studio that is so tiny that I don't even understand how people can make the work in it. And the work is almost the size of the wall and things are stacked up. And then I'll go to other studios that are so big that I think I would feel lost if I were in a studio that big making work. It's a real gift to be able to go to all these people's studios and see their palettes and their sculpting tools and like what they're listening to. And some people have an army of assistants. Other people are hesitant to ever have anyone set foot in their studio. So I guess the diversity of it is really compelling to me. It's basically like I do one a week and I never know what it's going to be like. And sometimes people will say, well, you've done 200. Aren't you going to run out of artists? And that's not the case because there's so many great artists out there. And they'll say, are you getting tired of it? Do you think you'll stop? Or when do you think you'll stop? And I always say that when I feel like it's getting boring or I just don't want to do it anymore, I'll stop. But it's so far, I mean, every week, you never know what you're going to get. It's really exciting.
And do you have any particular exhibitions or projects coming up?
I work with S-Edition. They're a animation digital art platform where you can download digital art and they show work around the world in public venues. And I have a new animation that will be playing in Korea, and that's coming up relatively soon. I don't have the exact date, but it's been confirmed. And it's the Park Roche in Korea. So I haven't shown work yet. I'm represented in Japan, and I try to go there every year or every other year. I've never been to Korea, so it's really exciting to show work there. I have a group show up right now at Kotaro Nukaga Gallery in Tokyo. And I have a couple solo shows coming up in 21 that I'm starting to make the work for. I have another project that seems like it's going through another public animation piece that will be in New York City that's in a really big public space, but it's not quite set in stone yet, but that's going to go through soon.
Well, that sounds very exciting. Well, I'd like to thank you so much for speaking with us today and sharing your innovative story and valuable insight. It's been a pleasure, and we wish you continued success.
Thanks so much. It was great to talk to you.
Thank you. For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to Art World Innovators on UMFM 101.5. Our guest this evening is Antonia Salmon. Her innovative burnished and smoke-fired ceramic sculptures belong to a modern tradition of British sculpture that refines forms found in the natural world. Antonia studied geography and archaeology at the University of Sheffield and pottery at the Harrow School of Art, where she was inspired by renowned ceramicists such as Lucy Rhee, Hans Koper. Currently, Antonia Salmon's studio is north of London in Sheffield, where she is close to the rivers and landscapes that continually inspire her sculptural forms. She has exhibited in Britain and internationally for over 30 years, lectured in ceramics at University of Derby, been a visiting lecturer in colleges, potters associations, art fairs, and has conducted workshops throughout Britain and Europe. Her work is represented in private and public collections throughout the UK, Japan, Europe, the US, China, Australia, and South Africa. It's a pleasure to have you speaking with us today from Sheffield, England. Hello, Antonia, and welcome to Art World Innovators.
Hello, Susan. It's a real pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. What is your earliest memory of a time when you felt a sense of your passion for ceramics and sculpture?
Well, thinking about that, I was remembering that my grandmother was an amateur potter, actually, and so she had us playing with clay in the garden. And I think around the age of four, I remember just feeling my hands burning with pleasure and sort of excitement and energy whenever I played with the clay. So that was a really early, visceral sort of sense of enjoyment. But then also my mother is a sculptor and my father was an architect. And so really I was brought up to love sculpture, and we went to art exhibitions, and at holidays we were taken all over Europe looking at cathedrals and things. So it's been in my upbringing to become very aware of form and space, art and architecture.
There were many remarkable potters in England that were active in the early to mid-1900s, such as already mentioned Lucy Riek and Bernard Leach and Hans Koper, to name just a few. Can you tell us how you may have been influenced by their works along with people that were important in your life, and what forms are you drawn to?
Well, I, you know, it's interesting. I didn't really know about the work of Hans Koper until I first started to train in the early 80s, and Lucy Rhee, of course. When I first saw Hans Koper's work, I was just blown away, because there's something that he touches, sort of primal and energetic and mysterious, something beyond form. And that to me has been a thread in my work always, remembering that even though you're making form, you can touch a mystery there. And of course, I've been, you know, not just influenced and inspired by potters, but by sculptors, you know, Gordie Breschka, Barbara Hepworth, and more, all the sort of early 20th century sculptors who were really using their material to inform the forms that they were making. So this is not about conceptual art. This is about people who really knew and understood the language of the materials that they were using.
Not only the materials, but they also took the natural landscapes and incorporated that into their forms, especially someone like Hepworth, and in an area so close to Sheffield where you are. How did your sculptures incorporate landscapes and nature in the forms and spaces?
Well, from very early on, I mean, you know, apart from these holidays in Europe looking at cathedrals, we've always did a lot of walking as a family. So the landscape has, even though I was brought up in London, we walked in the countryside a lot in Scotland and in the southwest of England on Dartmoor. So landscape has been a really important part of my experience. And there's, I think, something about walking through the landscape has always been for me a bit like walking through an enormous sculpture. So in a sense, that is how I look at landscape. I look at it almost as walking over a body of land. And of course, my works are much smaller. But when I am working on a sculpture, I'm so close to it that it is like inhabiting that landscape and going through it, really informing myself about the spaces between the forms. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yes, it does. And your sculptures are quite innovative and captivating in the sense and how you've interpreted the forms and landscapes. And it's also seen in many of your exhibits, such as Shaping Ceramics, from Lucy Rhee to Edmund de Waal at the Jewish Museum in London. That was in 2017. In this exhibition, they highlighted the ceramics that were inspired by those modernist ideas and imported to England in the early 20th century. And you included also a potter studio demonstration in that exhibit that can be viewed online. Can you describe one of your sculptures to give us a sense of experiencing your work in person?
Well, because the sculpture that was shown in the DVD for the exhibition was a sculpture called Touch Point, which was really about two elements which were just fixed but barely touching each other. One of the sculptures in the exhibition, which was the sort of newest one and is an area that I'm really interested in exploring further, is a sculpture called Windrush. And in a sense, how that's a mixed media sculpture. So in that one, I'm using ceramics. It's a ring of clay, a thick ring of clay, which I've thrown on the wheel. And when the clay is dried, I've cut that ring and sort of overlapped the two ends. So it's a broken ring. And then in the space, in the internal space inside the ring, I've incorporated wire. And this is a special industrial wire that you can put in a kiln. So I've fixed the wire into the clay ring and placed it so that it's defining and adding to the ring form, but also spikes of the wire are coming out and into the space in the middle. And with this wire, I've dripped clay, liquid clay called slip, over the wire. And when you put that on, it's a bit like, I don't know if you've gone out on a cold day and seen the dewdrops on a spider's web.
Yes.
So these little droplets are along the wire. And when the whole thing is fired, I'm hoping it will give a sense of the huge dynamism with the wires circling around the inner space, but also the sense of stillness within, that it's all contained within a ring. And the inspiration for the Windrush was listening, which may sound a bit odd, but a lot of my work recently has been focusing on capturing qualities of sound, such as the wind, such as the rain, such as water flowing down a stream. So in this one, it was the sound of the wind, and hence the name Windrush. I don't know if that gives you a sense of the sculpture.
It certainly does. You're very descriptive. From your writings about your artistic inspiration, such as the article Don't Look Now that was published in Ceramic Review in 2007, you eloquently reflect on your experiences and passions informing your sculpture. What are a few of the most significant discoveries, and how do they resonate in some of the other pieces that you've had in the exhibits?
Gosh, it's funny. When I've often thought about, you know, what are the main inspirations and themes in my work, and I think, I don't know if it's with other artists, but I find for myself, you know, you find a theme and you replay it in from different angles, and I guess always the focus has been on space, which might sound odd when one is actually adapting something solid to make a form, but the focus is on how the form penetrates into space and how form energizes the space around it and holds the space. Probably that's why I was so inspired by Hans Köper. So in a lot of the themes that I've been working with over the sort of 30 years, probably, I guess the strongest one is, how can I, in one piece, capture both a sense of stillness and a sense of dynamism? And I think the Windrush, you know, is a good example of that. But that's been developed, that idea of wanting to capture both dynamism and stillness, into some pieces where there's a quality of holding and letting go. And I have one sculpture which is called Holding Form, in which it's a form that holds a little bowl that you can pick up and take off. I think more recently, the main drive has been, how can I use my visceral experience of being in nature and communicate that in one sculpture? And that's much more difficult and more possibly more subtle, I don't know, but I find that really exciting. I am moved by artworks that give me a kind of an inner jolt in my body, and I want to use my sort of embodied experience to be communicated in sculpture. So that's where I am at the moment.
did you learn a lot from your experiences, and what secrets did you learn perhaps in India and the Middle East when you did some traveling, and how did these discoveries contribute to your experimentation and development?
Well, that was a really fantastic opportunity. I traveled across Europe down into Turkey and Syria, Jordan, Iran, and Pakistan, and into India. And I guess the original idea for that travel was because I became very interested in the art and architecture of Islam, and I wanted to sort of make a path, you know, from west to east, really looking at the mosques and the art. And a lot of the art is based on geometry. So that was really intriguing. And I think that geometry underlies a lot of the forms that I make, a love of pure geometry. I guess when I went to India itself, I spent a lot of time with traditional potters there, observing their making processes, observing the way that they fired in very simple kilns, you know, often in just a hollow in the ground, firing the pots amongst cow dung and brushwood. So really low technology methods of firing. And that inspired me. And because the quality of the work is so beautiful, particularly the water pots, and I thought I'd really like to use low technology methods when I came back to England. But then there was a secret, as it were, that something I got that I hadn't looked for in India, which has stayed with me always, is really to do with their attitude to work as a form of service. I guess I think it really supports me in remembering that in this work, I mean, it's a great privilege to be able to work as an artist, but to remember that I have a choice to do this work, and I have a choice in how I approach the work. I could make it an act of self-service, or I can hold an awareness that I really want to bring something excellent into the world. And that, I would say, is a secret I got from India.
Well, you certainly share that secret in your work. It's quite amazing. And I'd like to thank you very much for joining us on Art World Innovators. We appreciate you taking the time to be with us and share your story and insight.
Oh, well, lovely to talk with you, and I'm glad you've enjoyed it.
I have. Thank you so much. That was Antonia Salmon, the ceramic sculptor, speaking with us from her studio in Sheffield, England. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.